Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And Fred and I were just talking about accelerated live testing.
Well, that's because we got a question from one of our listeners or somebody that's following us a little bit. And the question, it started off with something I don't typically agree with when you do accelerated testing. They said, we have a chemical process and we're just going to need to assume that it's an activation energy of 0.7 EV. And I'm like, okay, strike one. But we don't have a lot of time and we, you know, can't afford a lot of samples and everything else, but we need to do an accelerated test to estimate its performance out, you know, off into the far distant future, something like that. All right. So you know what my response was. What would you answer to a question that starts like that? That wasn't even the question. That was just how it started.
So, I mean, the first response, accelerated live testing is where you're trying to use your understanding of the physics to change a stress here or a stress there to make whatever it is happen faster in a way you can measure. So you need to know the science. And I think lots of people have tried to combine different stresses into the one model with not a lot of success, but that's my first gut response to that scenario.
Yeah. And it's, so my gut response was very much along that lines. And I said, now, if you're trying to accelerate something that you know has a chemical process in it, go find a chemist and ask them.
Better one. Yeah.
You know, ask them, what is the activation energy for this process under these circumstances? And lo and behold, they actually have tools and techniques to tease out an activation energy, either from understanding the chemical process that's occurring. And they have the big fat books with lots of chemical symbols in it that, you know, it's sort of like alchemy to me. And then they could get some bubbling test tubes and, you know, they can relatively quickly determine. In many cases, not all cases, I'm sure, but in many cases, they could sort it out. And then you don't have to make that assumption.
Well, it comes down to information. I mean, when I first became involved in probability and statistics, I remember teachers and instructors and statisticians use this term information, but it just sounded too abstract for me. It didn't sound like anything really, really useful. But I really appreciate that is not an abstract term, especially when it comes to reliability stuff. Mm-hmm. Because when we go and get data and try and learn stuff from that data, the data contains information, but often we don't have enough data. So what do? We bring in a model which characterizes that particular phenomenon. And so that model actually contains information, and that's why we want to use models, because we could do a test. We could and have a million data points and which would let us know exactly what's going on for all intents and purposes. Mm-hmm. But we can't get a million data points. So we get 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 or whatever it is and combine that with the model. And that model gives us the rest of the information for us to make good decision. So to your point, when you talk about going to a chemist and say, well, they might know what's actually going on, that model represents information. And if you just say, well, assume 7, all you're doing is saying, well, we have a model, but not only does it contain no information, it might contain the wrong information and lead you down the wrong path. So models need to be treated for the vessels of information that they really are. They need to be respected for that role.
Yeah. And that's where I see people get to a point where they realize they need to do an accelerated test and they don't have the 6 months to run it. Or the funds to run it or whatever. And it says, well, then that's not an option. You're going to have to figure out another way to sort out how to make a decision here. If you have blocked yourself out for whatever set of reasons that, well, we can't run it that way, so we need to use really off-the-shelf unknown information or bad information, then you're more than likely going less than useful results that are going to, like you said, mislead you. So that was just the opening of this note. And the second part was, we also want to apply a load to it. And I didn't know if load meant like a physical compression. So I'll use pressure as a vector for this process. But whatever the load is, was mentioned is this, but is there a model that will do both the chemical, the Arrhenius part and the load part? So if I increase the loads and do this stuff, and it's like, maybe, I don't know what your process is or what, I don't have enough details to say, yes, definitively use this equation and you'll be fine. I didn't have enough information to comment on that. And I said, go to your chemist, go to those guys, go to the scientists. If there's a model out there and they don't know about it, then you can work with them to create a model. You might have to recreate what Arrhenius did and go do that kind of an experiment, multiple levels and multiple steps and all this stuff. And when you add a second variable to it, now it becomes really complicated, because the little bits and pieces I remember from high school chemistry class is that if you add pressure to a chemical reaction and temperature, they're not independent.
Right.
Pressure alone will change the rate of a reaction, because you just have more opportunity for collisions to occur. But then you add temperature on it, and those two things act like a whole nother variable on themselves. In some cases, they are good enough to be independent. But when you start interacting terms in a model, now you get one of those equations that takes the page, it just explodes. And then you want to run an experiment to determine those acceleration factors and those variables. You said you didn't have time to do a single stress test. Well, you certainly then don't have time to do one that has three variables, two that may have an interaction term, and then sort it out. Yeah. It's like, think about what you're trying to do here. Let's back up. What is it you're trying to accomplish? It gets ugly quick, doesn't it?
Well, if you're trying to measure reliability versus improve reliability, I'm guessing the guy who asked the question was trying to measure reliability because he's after a model. But you're sort of going into design of experiment territory, though. And design of experiments is cool in that it doesn't pretend to really quantify anything. It does give you some relative weight into different factors, which then you can go manipulate later on and work out. It also help you identify a dependence between certain factors as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't pretend to quantify anything really, and that's why it's very, very useful. It's just giving you a guide about what levers you might pull to improve whatever it is you're trying to do. But if it could, I'm sure they would love to be able to measure certain improvements, but so if you have anything more than even two parameters, it becomes a real struggle to quantify stuff.
Yeah. And to tease out what is the model, what is the relationship between these increased stresses back to use stresses and stuff. So the discussion, and we went back and forth a couple of times, and I think I got the point across that where you're going is not easily solvable unless somebody has written that paper or did that research on those fundamental properties you're looking for. And so if the chemist can't help you in your team and the scientists can't help you, go to the library, do a deep dive into the materials and the systems or the process that you're looking at, and is there a model there you can reasonably pull out? And the last thing is you got to do the big experiment. If it's important to have that answer that, hey, this thing will last whatever time frame with some probability, then that is a complex experiment. And it does take time, but it's weighted against, how important is it that you know the answer to that? And if they say, well, we need an answer next week, well, then open up a book to a random page number and say, there's your answer, because that's as good as you're going to get if you just make bad assumptions and use a poor model.
Exactly. And I think there's this urge here to measure stuff in a way that forces us to create stuff that's not there. And we know that, especially with accelerated live testing, there are other things at play as well. So pressure, for example, can change the state of something. Mm-hmm. We often think about states as simply, for example, water is ice, liquid water, or gaseous states. I mean, but there's other things that can happen as well. Eutectics and all those sorts of things come into play. But when you put pressure on something, the actual physical makeup of the device or the component or whatever it is you're testing can fundamentally change from how it's configured at an atomic level when the customer's going to use it. So when that happens, all bets are off. There's the model that you need to characterize at use conditions becomes completely irrelerant to your accelerated live testing scenario, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So it's not even just the complexities of using parameters. It's the fact that the thing you're studying might fundamentally change when you change the stresses.
I'd learned that once the hard way. When I was at HP, we often were looking at electronics packages, new styles of packages. And one of them was a very thin package profile. And it was on the order of a centimeter square, say. But we didn't know how well the solder would remain attached. And so we also realized it was going to take a long time to run a test for it. We knew from the geometry and everything else that this was probably good, but the question was, would it last 15 years? And we're like, maybe, maybe not. We don't really know. We got to run a test. And it would take 6 months or to a year to run the test. So one of the PhD types, no offense, Chris, no offense. One of the PhD types said,
I'm not a PhD type, you know.
That's right. And he said, well, if we, you know, the thermal cycling just takes time for the phenomena for the coefficient of thermal expansion difference to create the strain on the cross the solder joint. What if we just mechanically apply the strain? So let's grab the package and just move it to the right a little bit, you know, and we had Instron machines that we could move at a particular rate and a fixed distance, and it was pretty accurate. So we did some quick experiments to figure that out. And then we ran some components that we knew would fail relatively quickly so we can get a benchmark to what compares to what we already know is the lifetime of these solder joints. And we were pretty excited because in the order of like 2 days, we could create a very similar failure mechanism as what would take 6 weeks to do for these relatively poor kind of components. But then all hell broke loose at that point because the motion in a coefficient of thermal expansion is not like in the picture books. It's not just right. One goes left and the other goes right, and they stay perfectly parallel to each other. No, they bend and twist and contort, you know, at a very, very small amount. But the strain across the solder joint is not anywhere near just move it to the left a little bit and constrain it so it has to stay flat. And so all hopes were dashed at that point of being able to replicate this. And because when we got down into the details of it, it's like, nope, it is subtly different. And the more precise we tried to control it, the less we got away from the real application.
Which is the enduring challenge. If your model doesn't stay relevant, and you need to have a model to do accelerated live testing, it needs to remain relevant to the scenario. I've seen textbooks that try and combine things like temperature and relative humidity, and that's still a somewhat staple when you have this sort of pseudo Arrhenius equation, mm-hmm. which takes into consideration relative humidity, for example. But there have been that many studies which show that is a poor model, especially when those two factors combine.
Yep.
usually they tend to accelerate to your point for your circuit board is moving to the left. You think you're accelerating it in a very controlled way, but in practice you're not.
Well, and if only it behaved that way in real life, then we would have had something, but it doesn't. When you look carefully enough, where the failures occurred and initiated the cracks was different than, you know, it wasn't as different as it sheared versus crack propagation. But it was different enough that we were like, what's going on here? So then we started looking at it closer and realized that the motion in a normal daily thermal cycle is completely different than what we were replicating. And so the ability for us to translate that, those results, to the real results, what happens in real time, was just too many steps away. It was pretty bad. So the experiments went on for a while, and we tried to find correlations and stuff like that, but it was just way too noisy. It was the size factor of the components dominated. And so we really couldn't figure out and I imagine if they had enough grad students and enough resources, they could figure out a model for it, but it got complicated really fast. And so we just put a bunch of samples in the chamber and said, well, we really do need to know the answer to this before we put it on a bunch of products. So we'll do that and get it running. But that's the hard part. It's we often face timelines or resource constraints or all these different parts to it. It's much, much easier to do an accelerated life test when you've already done the characterization work. You already have a good, complete model. And now we can do a single stress acceleration and see how this one facet of it changes the performance. But you got to do the pre-work. And we often say, oh, we'll do that during development. And that's usually a death knell for doing anything accelerated test-wise, because we just don't have time then.
Well, actually, you touched on a really good point, because if you, let's just say you do a FMEA where you understand these stresses that matter, then you might actually come up with the designs that try to mitigate half this stuff in the first place. Mm-hmm. So not only do you come up with a more robust thing to test, it might actually respond a lot better to stresses because you've taken the time to consider those stresses in the design itself. If you know humidity is going to accelerate stuff, you might do something to shield your circuit board from humidity, or you might put fins on to really reduce the thermal loads or whatever it is, or you have a cooling system. So in a way, it's a sneaky way of getting out of having to do an accelerated life test, because to a point, I should say, because the temperature and humidity is going to be very, very controlled. And if it is controlled, you might be able to control the test in a way where you do get meaningful results. But that's a sneaky way of trying to get ahead of the curve. But yeah. I think most of the time people design the design and say, well, we better measure how reliable it is. Let's go.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, we got a ship starting, you know, next month. So
yeah,
you got a couple of weeks before we have to have results. And like, well, there's been a few, very, very few cases where I've been able to do that. It's the nature of the failure mechanism was such that we could accelerate it in an exorbitant amount safely. But I guess my note to listeners is, if you start your question with, well, we're just going to assume an MTB alpha something, you're probably not going to get a good result from my answer here. but it's to the point is to make sure that as you're looking at assumptions or looking for models, and I like your point, Chris, that those models contain information. If we apply that information correctly, we've got something. But waving your hand and going, well, we'll assume it's a factor of two here and do this, that, and other things, and then work out, we found this in the textbook, this might work for us, and it's unrelated whatsoever to your failure mechanism, that's pretty bold. And that should be done with open eyes and understanding what you're doing and how you're treating those models. Because the calculation will give you a number. What we want is that number to be meaningful. And it's too easy to get a meaningless number to six decimal points.
Mm-hmm. And that with the whole idea of information, there's information, lack of information, and misinformation. Misinformation is the worst, where you're making conclusions based on essentially you're testing product A as if it's product B. And so not only will you get answers which are not where you want them to be, they will describe a different scenario. At least if you don't have any information, you'll get your outputs won't involve a whole lot of certainty, but they won't be wrong either. Whereas if you use misinformation, they might be more certain or appear to have more certainty, but they might be fantastically off base.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, hopefully this doesn't dissuade you from sending us a comment or a question, but it brought up a point that I wanted to bring up, is that you got to pay attention to how you go about setting up and designing accelerated tests. It's not a trivial business, and it's too easy to get misinformation. So if you've got an idea or a comment, or you're facing a problem that you're just not quite sure of, let us know. Obviously, I love bringing up that kind of stuff and talking about it. But because it's a point of that we need to remember as we go about our business. And so you can find us over on AscendoReliability.com/go/SOR. There's a comment form there. Chris and I and the other hosts are also available through LinkedIn or on our about pages on the site. And any and all of those venues are great. You can find our email address just about anywhere on our sites also, so you can send us a note directly. But we certainly do enjoy hearing from you, and getting questions to feed into our discussions is great. It's a way for you to join the conversation. So with that, Chris, I think we'll wrap this one up, and hopefully we made a clear enough point to be careful with accelerated testing.
Right, and I don't think you or I are saying that accelerated life testing doesn't have a place. We think it's a very important tool you can use. You just need to know how and when to use it.
Yeah, exactly. So if you got a question like that, let us know. We're happy to help if we can, and then we'll talk about you on air.
That's right.
Hopefully for the benefit of our audience. So, All right, well, let's wrap this one up, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.